speaker is George Papadikolaou from Stanford. He will talk about imaging and plasma.
Okay, thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here, and thank you, John and Gunther, for inviting me to come here. I should right away mention my two collaborators who've been working for a while in this area, Liliana Boche and Kisula Tsonga. And there's a much larger group of people, about total 10 of us, who work on various aspects of this problem, including communications. But at the moment, Arnold Kim is here. He's another one. But at the moment, this particular work is what we have been doing since about January this year. So, I have no. This is work that we didn't. This is my first. My first lecture in a bioimaging environment. I don't think there are any MDs left here. It's all mathematicians. Am I making a mistake? Oh, okay, one, good. Or two. Okay, but I was not. I'm trying to learn the subject myself. So my own understanding of the subject comes from other areas, more interdisciplinary kind of problem. For example, the stuff that the ultrasonic imaging that Matthias Fink, that's how I started some years ago, from looking at his stuff, and before that on seismic imaging. So let me begin with the acquisition geometry. The acquisition geometry is actually a very important starting point of what it is that we want to image. And here I have, there are in general two points, XS and XR. XS is the source point along some surface, or some, doesn't have to be a plane surface, it could surround the object. And a pulse f of t is emitted, which goes to the location of the scatterer d that we want to image. And the scattering is recorded at XR. So the array data is a collection of time traces at, which depend on the source point and the receiver point. And in general, for the purposes of this talk, I'm coming from the radar business, and for seismic imaging, the source point and the receiver point can in general be on a surface. So this is a four-dimensional set of data, a time trace is a four-dimensional, so it's a five-dimensional data set in as much as it could be. It doesn't have to be the whole thing. And there are different acquisition geometries. There is a synthetic aperture imaging in which the offset is zero. The source and the receiver are at the same point. We're dealing with very large linear apertures in general, and the signals are broadband. We have ultrasonic imaging arrays. We saw the one, the little gizmo that that is used in Matthias's lab with 128 transducers. There are many, or maybe not so many, sources and receivers. The signals are broadband and so on in underwater sound. What I want to look here is I want to look carefully at resolution and noise issues, and to try to understand what's going on and what are some of the limitations, mathematically speaking. The first thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to stick to the model where the Born approximation for the scattering region is adequate. In other words, I'm going to assume that the background produces a noisy Green's function, a random Green's function. The background is noisy. It has it's a random medium. But the scattering, single scattering, is adequate for the scattering from the region where there is scattering. For some reason, there are many reasons why that could be quite adequate. So my model of the data received is this expression, which is simply the signal, the Green's function that takes you from the source to a scattering point. Then you multiply by the reflectivity, and then you take back the signal from some point y to the receiving point. You sum over all the region of reflectivity, and then you multiply, you do an inverse Fourier transform to take you back. This is the pulse shape function. I have another slide for this in a second. And it takes you back to what the time trace should look like. Now, the background Green's function satisfies this partial differential equation, the Helmholtz equation, with an index of refraction, which is in general random. It has a background part, it has a smooth variable background part with this velocity c of x, and it has a random part where the mu of x are the random fluctuations in the background, which are characterized in the absolutely simplest case by two parameters, a strength parameter sigma, which is might be a few percent, or you heard the 5% a few couple of lectures before. 5-6 in my experiments, we used even 2 or 3%. Maybe we went up to 8%. We go normally, and a size parameter, which is L, the typical distance between which these fluctuations in the medium remain correlated. And this is one of the simplest models you can have. Now, the probing pulse, this is the simplest probing pulse that you can have, is simply a pulse that is has a central frequency omega 0. It has a band-limited pulse f of t. It's a very narrow pulse, so that the bandwidth is broad. And this is the Fourier transform of this pulse. And the carrier frequency is omega 0. There's a lot more sophisticated pulses that you can send out. I want to build a theory on the simplest possible pulse. I will mention at the end other things that you can do. Broadband is important in imaging when there is noise. Absolutely, and that will become clear as I go on. In a homogeneous background, I remind you that the Green's function is simply e to the I omega times the travel time between the point x and y divided by this by the distance. And the travel time is distance divided by speed in a homogeneous medium. Now, I want to make a few comments about the structure of the inverse problems. We are solving an inverse problem, but we're not solving the absolutely full inverse problem, because I have already, by going into the Born approximation for the reflectivity, I've already put my cards on the table for you. I'm primarily interested, I want to reconstruct the reflectivity. I've already separated in three parts in order of interest to me. I really want the reflectivity. I want to know where is a strong reflector. This is often the contrast in the propagation speed. It could be, for example, I have a background with some propagation speed and I have somewhere localized a very high contrast in the speed, and I isolate that, that's the contrast, and I try to identify that. A secondary goal, and then I have this comment here, when is the Born approximation adequate? That's a serious discussion. We constantly do numerical experiments on that. In the numerical experiments that you will see, we do not make the Born approximation. So we built a theory on the Born approximation, but whenever we can, when we do numerical experiments, we use a full theory. The secondary goal is to reconstruct the background, and that, at least in seismic imaging, is perhaps the most important problem, because in seismic imaging, this cannot be assumed to be a constant. It's not known. It's called the velocity estimation. Same for the underwater sound problem. That's a very big problem in some areas. I don't think it's such a big problem in medical imaging. This may involve, here, the C of Y doesn't have to be smooth. It could involve discontinuities, but somehow we believe that this is the part of the medium that we know, or we can determine separately by preliminary measurements. Like, for example, when you do repeated imaging of a healthy person, and then you discover the tumor when the tumor emerges somehow at the later stage when you have kept the information, the previous information. So this is needed in the places where this is really a big issue. It is because in order to construct the reflectivity, you need travel times, you will see in a minute, and to get travel times, you have to know what the background velocity is. Another secondary goal is to characterize the overall properties of clutter. Clutter is what I'm interested in, and I will pretty much ignore this for the rest of the lecture. But clutter is something that you don't want to know. You're not interested to know what clutter is or how exactly to characterize it. The only thing you really want to know is, in a bulk way, how does clutter affect the resolution, the statistical aspects of your problem. And this is what you don't want, more information than you need, because that will be only an obstacle to you. Now, I have one slide here where I show you what synthetic aperture imaging is, or sometimes this is the same word, it's called zero offset migration. It's very, very widely done, both in seismic imaging, it's not so much in seismic imaging as much as in radar, but also in seismic. And it's very simple. It's very simple. Many of you know it by different names, but it's an extremely simple thing. It's where the source and receiver are at the same point. You take the traces, and then when you evaluate the traces at twice the travel time in the homogeneous background to go from the source to some imaginary or search, S is for search, scattering point and back. If this YS is close or on top of a real scatterer, this P will be large at this time. This trace will have a peak at that time. And therefore, this is a, if the object is sufficiently deep, this is for arrays that have a large aperture. If the aperture is relatively narrow, this is 1. The Y3 is the coordinate in the direction down into the medium. This is approximately 1. If you sum these traces like this, you create an imaging functional. That's the Kirchhoff migration imaging functional. And this goes back, I don't know, this goes back at least 40 or 50 years as an imaging functional, and that's the basis of a very large part of synthetic aperture imaging. I wrote it here also in Fourier space. If I take the Fourier transform of the traces in Fourier, it's like that. And then just do it mentally, the transformation. This is an integral d omega. This is e to the 2i omega tau, the travel time. This is this one here. This is, I could write this as either p multiplied by e to the minus. I have the data, and then I back propagate, if you wish, or I can conjugate, phase conjugate the data and propagate normally into the medium. It's interchangeable, but I think you will recognize this as a phase conjugation back propagation step here. This is the back propagating the data to YS. That's exactly what Kirchhoff migration is. If the array, so now there's a fundamental theorem. The fundamental theorem of synthetic aperture imaging is this one that says that if the array is large, and if the bandwidth is also large, then this IKM of YS reconstructs arbitrarily well with increasing fidelity the reflectivity rho at YS in deterministic homogeneous medium. This is the fundamental theorem of synthetic aperture imaging. It's not very hard to prove. It goes back. It's underlying it is some kind of a Radon transform. It goes, I think there are many treatments of that. Greg Belkin some years ago. Norm Bleistein has it in his book. Margaret Cheney has looked at this from another point of view. There's a number of mathematicians have really dwelled on this and its significance. You can, if you're willing to spend some time on it, you can get really precise resolution estimates here. You can get this result for not only for zero offset, but for fixed offset, for other geometries that are two-dimensional. They do not use the full four-dimensional data set. This is only a two-dimensional data set is used. The redundancy of the data is not necessary. The redundancy of the data could be used to mitigate noise effects or for velocity estimation, for any number of other issues, but theoretically speaking, you don't need it. Now, how does synthetic aperture imaging do in clutter? And here I write for you, I will explain first heuristically why it won't do well, and then you will see it in the numerical data. First of all, if you plug in into the previous formula, the Born approximation, the theoretical model for the traces, for the measured data, you will see that it's like that. You have two random Green's functions. Okay, so you have two random Green's functions integrated over the reflectivity region. And then these random Green's functions, if they were deterministic Green's functions, if the g hat zeros, they would equal e to the I omega tau, the travel time, from xs to y over 4 pi, xs minus y, like that. And you can see that I have a travel time from xs to y here, a travel time from xs to y, that means twice the travel time from xs to y. And all the migration does is it tries to subtract it off. Because whenever ys is close to one of the scattering points, there's linear cancellation here, this becomes an approximate delta function and reconstructs the row. That's how it works. But not when this is random, because it won't look like this. And if you want to think of it like this, the tau will be random. It won't be quite the correct thing. So, therefore, you're trying to cancel a random phase of this Green's function, the random phase of these Green's functions, with a deterministic phase, and you're not going to do well. There's no way this can happen in a reasonably good manner, you need offset data. You definitely, here you need the redundancy. And, let's see how that, let's see some figures. So here's a numeric, a very simple numerical example. The numbers are from the ultrasound regime. You have a region, the wavelength is about a half a millimeter. We're in this 3 megahertz region. This is what the background speed of propagation looks like. This is like your random medium with its speckles in the background speed of propagation. And here's where the spot is, a hard spot that reflects. It's about 2 centimeters down into the medium, 48 wavelengths. The array is not very big, it's about 4.5, it's just not very big at all. 4.5, I think it's about 4.5 lambdas. These objects are placed half a wavelength apart, so they're about 10 array points. And the fluctuations in the sound speed are of the order of 5%. So let's see how when you do synthetic aperture image, you apply this Kirchhoff migration formula, what do you get? Well, here's what you get. If the medium is deterministic, you get a very good location of the spot in the range direction. This is in millimeters here, range. This is cross range. You get very good location of the spot in the range. That's because the range resolution is controlled by the bandwidth, which is is quite narrow bandwidth. I mean broadband. But the cross-range resolution is controlled by the aperture. The aperture is not very wide. If I had twice the aperture, this is roughly would be about half the size of the spot. But this is the resolution for the aperture that I have. Now, if I put in 2%, 2.3% noise, look, I lose the resolution completely. I create speckles in the cross-range direction. If I go to 4.6%, I lose it completely. Another realization, slightly less noise, but more clutter in the image. Just doesn't work. There's no reason why it should work. I'm doing a dumb thing. I'm trying to cancel the random phase with a deterministic one. It's not going to work. So let's back off and try to understand theoretically why this happens. And let's now consider a simpler problem, which is the problem of an active source radiating onto an array. So I record the data at the array. The Fourier transform of the recorded traces is a function of XR only. This is actively radiating out with a pulse, the same pulse shape, F hat sub B of omega minus omega 0, center frequency omega 0, bandwidth B. And now this is the Green's function, the random Green's function that takes me from the location Y of the scatter, which is not known to me, to GXR. So this is the data. The Y is unknown, and I want to locate it. I want to find out where is this source beaming from. So if I knew the Green's function, this audience here, I can go very quickly because you really know this stuff here. If I knew the Green's function, meaning if I knew not quite the travel time, but if I really knew the real Green's function of the medium as a random medium, then I would simply phase conjugate my data and propagate it back into the medium. This is just what physical time reversal. That's what Matthias Fink does in his lab. He takes his data, he conjugates it, and then sends it back, and then this is the resolution function. This is how the data would focus in the vicinity. If you go at some search point YS, put your measuring probe at some point YS nearby, this is the field that you would measure. And the remarkable thing that I'm sure everybody here knows about this is that the focusing resolution of this is much sharper in a random medium than it is in a deterministic medium. The resolution in the deterministic medium being lambda of the order of lambda 0 L over A, the size of the array. And in a random medium, there's a concept of an effective aperture, which is in general much bigger than A, and therefore you end up with super resolution. You get that the back propagated signal focuses much more tightly around the object. And I want to be aware of this, and I want to say, okay, how is that going to help me for imaging? And the key to doing good imaging in random media is interferometry. This is something that we've been doing for a while, and here we've developed some theory for, and not only us, but many others too. And the way you think of this is like this. You say, you remember what was wrong with synthetic aperture imaging. It was that it was trying to reconstruct the phase of the received signal of this, you know, you have the signal that is being scattered, and you try to reconstruct the phase so that there's approximate cancellation. Well, the principle in everything that follows is never try to cancel phases, only deal with phase differences. So you should never, whatever it is that you do, there should never appear naked phases anywhere. There should always be only phase differences. So that's exactly what interferograms, so time autocorrelations, do. So what does a time autocorrelation do? It says, take the trace and then convolute it in time at a slightly different point, R prime, nearby, autocorrelated with this time reversed part. So this would be like, for example, taking the signal and not quite, so it has a time reversal interpretation, but it's just, you know, that's just for you mentally to think about it, is you have the point XR here and you have another point XR prime, and this trace. So it's saying this is some unknown point that is beaming out. So you say, take the signal, take the trace that came to you like that, and then autocorrelate it with a signal that you might, that is really the time reverse signal, the time reverse trace that you received at XR prime. So I plot it this way. And you cross correlate them, or you convolute them. And if you think about it, this is as if this was a point on an array at which this is let's say a source that is sending you a signal. You time reverse it and you take it over there. So the correlation between these two should behave of the order of lambda 0 L over A sub B. The coherence between two traces correlated like that should be of the order of the spot size and time reversal. Okay? Now, if you evaluate this at the time, so you go to a test point YS over here, and you say, let me compute the deterministic travel time from here to there. Okay? Now, this is the travel time, so you go this way, you go that way, you go this way, and that way, so just the opposite. And so here you have the difference between two random travel times, here you have the difference between two deterministic travel times. And you try to match the difference of the two random travel times with the difference between the deterministic travel times. So you evaluate this. You evaluate this autocorrelation at the lag, which is this travel time difference, to the test point YS. This is a very good functional to look at. It's statistically stable. It has no noise at all. It's very clean with respect to noise. Not at all. It has some noise, of course. But even if you don't sum over the nearby points, it's very stable statistically. This is something that we pursued mathematically, and we understand it very well. This is a broadband phenomenon. Now, if you add the traces over near, how much adding do you have to do here in the neighborhood of some point? Of course, this depends on the neighborhood of some point. I should point that this really, well, you can add over the whole array here. You can add over the whole array, okay? But only nearby points that are of the order of the speckle size will contribute to this sum. And then you move somewhere else, and then the nearby points will contribute. So this is a very good functional to look at. If you look at what this is in the frequency domain, it's nothing but this. I mean, you can do mentally, you can do the Fourier transform of this. The absolute value squared is this autocorrelation. And this is the migration part. You migrated it. I can call this differential Kirchhoff migration rather than ordinary Kirchhoff migration. And now you look at this and you say, wait a minute, this is nothing but the almost the matched field imaging functional. It's something that is very widely used, especially in underwater sound. And that is the case where you simply take the traces of your data and you backpropagate it in a homogeneous medium to a test point. Because that's the only thing you know. You don't really know the random medium. And then instead of looking at this object as you would in time reversal, instead of looking at this backpropagation by itself, you autocorrelate it in time. Okay? Why do you do that? Because that's exactly what produces differential phases. Now the phases, the random phases here come in conjugate pairs. The deterministic phases here come in conjugate pairs. And only relative phases play a role. Okay? Now, so I have pretty much made all the comments that are written on this slide. So this is, of course, what the deterministic Green's function is. And to image, we use the Green's function of the homogeneous reference medium because we do not know the random Green's function. We can never really know it. We backpropagate with the best available information, which is that of a homogeneous medium, but we backpropagate not anything, we backpropagate the interferograms. And now you can look at that object that I showed you before, and you can do a nice theoretical study of it, and you find that this interferometric imaging functional behaves like this. This is an asymptotic expression it has. I don't have time to explain the theory behind this, but there are papers on this that we have. And what is interesting here is that the range L of the object appears, the unknown object is at range L, offset 0. And the effective aperture appears, but it appears in a way underneath. The bigger the effective aperture, the broader the structure of this. And this also shows you that you can only recover the ratio of the effective aperture to the range. You cannot recover separately the range and the effective aperture. So to get the arrival times, you have to either get them directly from study of arrival times, so it's a different kind of windowing of the traces, or by triangulation. I will do the second one. Now, actually, here I'll do actually both, because in the next one. So I'll show you in the same setup that you remember, the numerical setup of the spot that I had here. I now do this imaging that I mentioned, this matched field or interferometric imaging. You do this to this, and not with an active. Actually, it's with a passive source, not with an active. This formula is for an active source. It's almost the same, except for a factor of 2 when the source is passive, which is a very interesting result in itself, for reasons that I won't go into here. But you can see that, this is the matched field, the functional. It doesn't give you any resolution in the range direction at all, but it gives you excellent cross-range resolution. And by looking the cone, the angle of the cone is a very sharp estimator of the effective aperture for time reversal, the focusing spot size. Very sharp and statistically stable. Now, if you combine arrival times with this thing here, which we did some years ago, is you get an extremely, this is with noise now, about 2.5%, you can go up to 5, 6, 7% noise, you recover the spot size almost perfectly. The noise has disappeared. So this is very effective, and it has a good theory. The question is, how do you go to the general problem from this, to the general reflectivity problem? Obviously, we need to use large arrays. We should use the array data sparingly in order to stabilize the information that it has. And what we're going to introduce is a new method of coarse graining the data so as to take out the effects of clutter in a systematic way. We call this the local data covariance reduction. So what I'm going to show you is how to take the array imaging in clutter, the data, the traces that you collect, the very highly resolved traces that you collect, with your acquisition geometry. And then you convert the imaging in clutter problem to a deterministic image deblurring problem. In other words, you do not try to do as anything like a synthetic aperture imaging thing, but you look at what the time autocorrelations will give you, and you get what you get from that. So what you say is, suppose that I have a lot of data in the vicinity of the source. Let's say some source point excess. I choose nearby sources XS prime with an array of A, size AS. In the vicinity of some XR receiver point, I choose nearby receiver points with a size A sub R. And then I look at my data, namely these traces, okay? And I autocorrelate them, this object without the sum. This is just the autocorrelation of the traces at two nearby points, two nearby S's and two nearby R's. I differentially migrate them to a search point YS. I integrate the omega and I sum over nearby. These sums are over a few time reversal spot sizes, respectively here. AS and AR are slightly bigger, of the order of 5 or 6 spot sizes for refocusing, for time reversal focusing. And so I get a coarse-grained functional, which depends on some generalized coordinate OS. The coarse grain has grouped the data here. OR has grouped the data there. YS, the search point out here, trying to identify this region. And no time, the time has been taken out by the migration. This functional is a very good functional to work with. It's very stable. It has some very nice properties. And so what exactly do you have? Well, here's what the functional looks like theoretically. If you plug in the Born modeling formula for the background, you get the 4 random Green's functions. And you get each travel time here has two travel times, so there are really 4 one-way travel times here. Okay, 2 are the ones that go from the direct point SR, and 2 that go from S' R'. And the interesting thing about this is that there are 4 random Green's functions, but they are grouped in conjugate pairs in a nice way. Okay, is there a question? No. Okay. So you have this, and this one you can calculate everything. You can calculate a very nice expression for this, which is this one. It turns out that when you put in a theory, a remote sensing regime theory, you do some other asymptotics. I'm not going to go into this at this moment. But if you go into the details of this, but this formula is just it's the intersection of 2 matched fields. If I go back a little bit to motivate this. If I go back at this formula, where this is the ratio of the transverse over the longitudinal coordinate of the search point, L plus eta is the longitudinal coordinate of the search point. This is the square, the ratio of the squares. And this is, notice that the effective aperture, the blurring, is in the denominator here. If I rewrite this a little bit, and this is saying the following. If I have this object here, okay, and if I have a little array here, then around this point, then I will determine, I'm interpreting the, let me go back to this formula. I'm interpreting this formula. This formula is a convolution of an anisotropic Gaussian with effective apertures in the denominator here added in some way. Y is Y1, Y2, Y3 are the coordinates of the point that you integrate Y. And Y1S, Y2S are the search point, YS. And this is a convolution. And to interpret this is let's say, at OR, OS, let's say, and this is at OR. Okay? So this is, from here there's another cone. And so this is kind of an intersection of 2 cones. And this is the angle, the offset angle. And you can see that there is a kind of a triangulation. If there is no offset, if alpha equals 0 here, then the cosine of alpha is 1, the sine of alpha is 0, so the y3 coordinate disappears, and you get absolutely no depth information at all. So depth information is lost, so all the depth information you get from here is from triangulation. That's an extreme, because I have done no windowing at all of the data. I have used no arrival information. But this is a benchmark. It really tells you what interferometry in a strongly scattering medium will give you. It's really equivalent to a smoothing by a Gaussian. Okay? Now, here are some comments. The local data covariance reduction, in other words, the construction of local matched fields, is not an imaging in itself of the reflectivity. But it does reduce in a very precise manner the imaging in clutter to an image deblurring with noise problems. In other words, it says, when you do to the data what I suggested, then now this reduced data set should be modeled as the convolution of an anisotropic Gaussian, which depends on the source and receiver points, the coarse-grained source and receiver points, depends on a set of parameters, the blurring apertures. It's convoluted with a rho squared rather than rho, and of course there's some noise because this reduction is not exact. This is what you did to the data empirically. This is just something that theoretically comes out, so there's some noise. But the noise that you have, this noise is a lot smaller, much smaller, than the noise you had in the original data before you did the interferometry. So what you have exchanged is, you have said the original very noisy data has been reduced to data that is much less noisy. But then, instead of having here the Kirchhoff model, you have a convolution, you have a smoothing that has taken place, so you have exchanged smoothing for reduction of noise. Now, the local data covariance coarse graining, for the local data covariance coarse graining, you need some prior information, prior estimate of the effective apertures. In other words, if this is not going to be a blind deconvolution problem with many, much data here, much redundant data, different SNRs, if you are going to really pretend that you know the theta, then you have to do some preliminary estimates, and the theory tells you how to do that with carefully constructed experiments. The theory tells you how to estimate effective apertures, how to collect good array data. Not all array data are really good for imaging. And then how to do the LCD, local data covariance coarse graining. Of course, the key to resolution enhancement in deblurring is having multiple views. The key here is that you use your data sparingly. So here, you have a very, very large data set. SNR are still a very large set so that you can go below the... This is also called super resolution. This is a problem that appears in many areas in astrophysics. This is the deblurring of galactic pictures through telescopes. This is really the theory that goes into that, based on this, on such a formula. Then I have my conclusions. Well, the first one is the mathematics behind all this. And now we have a well-established theory for the random Schrödinger equation, which is a model for the random medium, which is largely sufficient for a lot of the what is done here for a good interferometric local data covariance coarse graining. This is quite sufficient, but of course it's not everything. There's a lot of stuff that we are not reaching with this. This local data covariance coarse graining is controlled in a very precise, is a controlled reduction of the data, and it minimizes the effect of clutter when you have highly resolved imaging data. If you don't have highly resolved imaging data, if you have data that is sparse or data that, if you have data that's sparse, then what I've shown is not quite the right thing to do. You should use more matrix methods. You should use the singular value decomposition. There are many things that you should be using there if the data is sparse. If the data is very well resolved in the acquisition geometry, then these aperture ideas should be quite adequate. Research directions. Well, there are a huge number. I mentioned just one here. I have shown you two extremes. I have shown you two complete extremes. One, what the theory looks like, the Kirchhoff migration theory, when the data is clean, when there's no noise. We have a very good theory for that. A lot of it is, the mathematics behind it is the Radon transform, curvilinear Radon transform. And then we also have the extreme data where you have the random medium is sufficiently incoherent that you end up with, when you do interferometry, yes, you reduce the noise, but you get very serious blurring. Blurring by Gaussian is about as serious a blurring as you can incur. So interferometry by itself does not do miracles. On the other hand, there are situations, there are intermediate situations where if you window the data, if you probe the data differently, if you use much more sophisticated probing pulses, that you can reach intermediate situations because this between this very incoherent situation and the purely coherent, and that's an extremely interesting area to deal with. It requires a lot of numerical experiments to see what you're doing. The theory doesn't always reach in these nooks and crannies, but I think these are two benchmarks from which you can gauge where you are. Thanks very much.
Okay, questions, please.
Yeah.
Back several slides, you talked about using the homogeneous Green's function. And you must have considered is to look at some average quantity.
Where are you going? But where do you want to go? Here? Further back?
Why, in several places in the talk. You have to make a choice about the green function. You don't know the background media.
Right. Right.
So you make a choice of a homogeneous media.
Yes.
On the other hand, you might
right here.
At least think about doing some average. So determine an average mean somehow average. Is there a reason why you don't do it?
I only have the data. I only have the data. And I have a medium in front of me. And if I want to calculate the average of something, I have to know what it is that I'm going to average. Where am I going to get this information that I'm going to average?
Well, I would that the Green's function you might want to target would be a Green's function that would include average properties.
I could put a lot of modeling into this, and that, of course, in underwater sound, where the medium is more like a waveguide, and there are the surface, there's the bottom, there's some structure of the bottom. There are a lot of features that are known. If you know roughly where you are, and you have previous knowledge of the large-scale topography, you can put this information into your Green's function. That's really what the matched field method is about. Well, no, I think this is an important thing. It's because you don't really have the data. And this idea that you somehow average is the kind of thing that I want to pinpoint down. There are good ways to average and there are bad ways to average. If you have an object that is arriving here and then it's arriving over there, the trace, and you average, it's going to smear it out. And you're going to lose resolution. The whole point here is that you don't just average. You average the correct quantity. And that's really the point, is you match the phases here, so that they come in conjugate pairs. Okay?
In your numerical experiments, how do you say I add notes, but how do you do that concretely?
Which problem are you talking about? Which part?
When you at the beginning you have a quantity mu of x over L.
Yes.
And then you show us how Kirchhoff migration is bad. When
yeah.
You don't have, right. So then you say I'm going to create a kind of a clutter media. How concretely do you do that?
That's exactly how I did it. I took a Fourier series for the mu,
okay,
with a random Fourier series, with random coefficients, independent Gaussian coefficients. I constructed the correlation function, which has this correlation length. The correlation function is actually Gaussian here. And then I ran the full numerical experiment here. I solved this equation fully, no approximations. And the scatter was a little Dirichlet hard spot. And that's it. There were non-reflecting boundary conditions.
And how did you choose this parameter, little L?
A little L in the medium, in the spot. Thank you for reminding me this. I didn't mention it. I think it's on the slide, though. The correlation length is of the order of the wavelength here. Okay, you can kind of pick it up with your eye. This is in millimeters here. And you can see the typical distance between two peaks, either blue or, is of the order of a half a millimeter here, which is the order of the correlation length. Matthias?
All what you present, take into account the self-averaging property of time reversal, and this needs a large bandwidth.
Yes.
And you don't comment on this. For example, in your simulation, which is very interesting, you don't comment on how large was
50%.
50%.
The bandwidth in these numerical experiments are about 50%. Maybe even a little bit more here. This is more like 80%, this one. It's very broad band. Decrease the bandwidth if you go down. The crossover in the qualitative behavior of the data, if we drop below 15-20%, we begin to see fluctuations of the correlations.
This means that all this technique is a frequency diversity technique, in fact.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but in a coherent way, you use the frequency diversity.
Absolutely. It's a diversity technique. It's a technique where the frequency diversity is exploited to the maximum.
I understand when you speak of interferometry, but when I think of the technique for astronomy, where they use the interferometry techniques to improve the quality when there are turbulence, they use very differently the turbulence because it was through the change of turbulence that they average. In your case, it's very different. You have just one, what you call a random media, but it is a random fixed media. It don't change.
There is a large variety. In the astrophysical problem is not, there are many different things that people do. For example, astrophysicists, back in the 1960s, this model, astrophysicists would they would write a model like this almost right away for the image that they receive on your photographic plate. You receive intensity, you don't receive phases, and since you open the lens for a little bit of time, maybe a few minutes, what you receive on the plate is an average, because it gets averaged, so you get a blurring, because the signal has gone through the atmosphere and the star appears to be scintillating in its location. So you want to de-blur the image and you have really this problem. Now, in this few minutes that the signal, let's say you had the thing open, I don't think, they don't assume that the atmosphere has changed. They assume that the atmosphere has frozen for these few seconds probably. But they do not use, they use a more complicated, sophisticated model for the turbulence, Kolmogorov turbulence. So this kernel is not a Gaussian kernel, it's a slightly different kernel that takes into account the Kolmogorov turbulence. And then when they want to have multiple looks, when they want to have, for example, they want to take stroboscopic, it's very similar to the kind of work that you do where they take stroboscopic. If it's, let's say, a satellite that is moving and they are tracking the satellite, and they want to take atmospheric turbulence into consideration, they take a picture here, and then the satellite moves, they take another picture, and they deal with the multiple looks through an inhomogeneous medium that way. And it's the multiple looks that allow you to reduce, to get the super resolution at the intensity level. Yeah? Yes. This is a finite integral. This is a finite bandwidth. This is a finite integral, the omega. This is a finite bandwidth signal. Are you worried about the mathematics behind this?
No, I'm just wondering, what's the physical assumption? Is there a physical assumption?
No, there's no. This is just that they are equivalent expressions. This and that, this is the Fourier transform version of that. They're identical. Yeah, they're real quantities, so the conjugation is not gonna. There was another question, Frank.
You showed us nice pictures about how you can point scale, point like
scale. Yes.
What can you do for an extended scale?
This is the theory. This is the extended scatter.
Yeah.
I haven't done the numerical. I haven't. That's absolutely right. This is where, this is our. I hope that next time I run into you, I will have all the data. We're working very hard on that. That's my, you know, my summer vacation. I have a sabbatical next year. I hope everything gets done. That's absolutely right. I have not. There's a lot of, by the way, this is not just doing numerical computations to confirm the theory. Hardly. The numerical simulations are absolutely essential because they will. There are all sorts of implementation ideas here that are all over the place. I didn't even mention, the probing pulse idea. I mean, the probing pulse, I took it in the dumbest possible way. There are all sorts of clever things you can do.
Okay, thank you very much. Our next speaker is Sarah Pett.